Welcome to Two-Way Street. In this election cycle, we've heard an awful lot about the importance of the evangelical vote. When politicians and the media talk about evangelicals, they usually mean white conservative Republicans. And the candidates competing for those voters tend to hew to very conservative views, skeptical of gay marriage, fearful of undocumented immigrants, convinced that Christianity is under attack. But Jim Wallace, our first guest today, says that this is a misreading of what the concept of evangelicism is really all about. Wallace is a progressive Christian writer and political activist. He founded Sojourners magazine and a Christian-based community in Washington, D.C. that goes by the same name. He describes the publication and the work of the organization as being dedicated to putting faith into action for social justice. Wallace served on the White House Advisory Council on Faith-Based and Neighborhood Partnerships. He's a pastor and the author of 12 books. He's taught at Harvard and Georgetown, among other universities. Wallace visited the Two-Way Street studio recently to talk about his new book, America's Original Sin: Racism, White Privilege, and the Bridge to a New America. But in this election season, we also talked extensively about his views on the role of religion in politics. Jim Wallace, it's such a pleasure to have you here for Two-Way Street. Thank you very much for coming in.
Blessed to be here.
Your book makes it clear you believe quite deeply that slavery was original sin that needs to be cleansed in some way, yes?
And it's even deeper than slavery because, as we all know, the Romans had Greek slaves, but they taught their elite children. They just lost a war. That's why they were slaves. In this country, we created this venal kind of slavery, which said that in order to treat these kidnapped Africans as chattel property, you had to throw away what we call imago Dei, the image of God. You got to say they're not really human. They're not fully human. This isn't just old stuff. A kid in Ferguson, young man, said to me last year, "I still feel like I'm treated like three-fifths of a person." Now, that was written in the Constitution, and he's the existential feeling he has as a young black teenage kid today. And so really this was saying at our founding that black lives and bodies matter less than white lives and bodies. The Black Lives Matter movement is striking directly at this original sin.
But of course, as you say, this is more than just about white America's treatment of African Americans. It's also about indigenous peoples. If I can read to you very early in your book, you say, "The language of America's original sin helped me understand that the historical racism against America's indigenous people and enslaved Africans was indeed a sin, and one upon which this country was founded." That's a profound statement to suggest it is a foundational element of who we are.
So how do we deal with that now? How do we... Repentance means turning around, going in some different directions. So people, I think, are hungry for a conversation, but in the, as you know well, being a political reporter, the media is obsessed with the state of the race. Mm-hmm. And we're talking about the state of race in America and even how it's impacting the horse race.
Yeah.
So I think the book is always going to be painfully timed. I knew this book would be painful in its timing, and I wasn't sure what was going to happen.
Help us understand the why you chose this path and how it happened that a young white man in Detroit decided to try to learn so much about the other in his community.
So I was a teenager, about 15, and I'm now reading the papers and hearing the news and having conversations, and something really big seemed really wrong in my city and my country. And nobody was talking about it in my white world, white church, white neighborhood, white school. And who was this guy in the South named King, this minister? And what was he saying? What was he up to? Nobody would talk about it. So I had to go into the city to get answers to these questions. They taught me the song as I was a kid to sing, "Red and yellow, black and white, they are precious in his sight. Jesus loves little children of the world." But the only children I saw were white children. You know, what was going on here? And I got taken in by black churches who were very kind, this teenage kid with all these obvious questions.
Well, wait, I have to stop you already. Here you are, a white teenage kid. Yeah. Your friends are out playing baseball. They're playing football, whatever. They're going to dances. And you're on your own knocking on the doors of black churches and saying, I'd like to learn about you. That in itself is fascinating.
Well, I always tell young people, trust your questions and follow them. Follow them where they take you, because that'll what will be the thing that changes you. I've always learned most about the world from being in places I wasn't supposed to be and meeting people I was never supposed to meet and becoming friends with them. That's what's changed my life more than anything else. And it really just began to open my eyes. These questions that just wouldn't go away. My mother used to say, bless her heart, two things to me. She said, now, if there's a kid in the playground that no one's playing with, you play with that kid. And if I see you in a playground with a kid no one's playing with, you're in trouble, unless you're playing with that kid. Or she said, if there's a bully on the playground, you be the one to stand up to him. Now, she never applied that, my folks, to politics. But those were the principles they raised us with. And I think, you know, I was just trying to apply them to the world as I saw it. And
what do you remember as a teenager, as you walked into black churches? What were some of the first impressions and learning experiences?
There was this young black leader who I'll see next week in Los Angeles again, Bill Pinnell, who wrote a book called My Friend, the Enemy. Mm-hmm. And he was talking about his friends, white Christians, as a black Christian who really were acting like the enemy, and how for him that was a fundamental contradiction. So I met young guys like him, and I met this young man, Butch, who took me home for dinner, and we were janitors at Detroit Edison Company. And I'm old enough that we had elevators back then, and the elevator operators, when they were sick or something, or on vacation, Butch and I would fill in for them. And you get a break in the elevators in the morning and the afternoon because your head starts to spin. So in my break, I'd go in his elevator right up and down with him. We'd talk in his break. He'd come in right up and down with me. And we'd just talk and talk and talk. And that's what really can change us. And that's the powerful thing that I think is before us now, a new generation that's very multiracial, multicultural. And they want a different kind of country and expect a different kind of country. The Black Lives Matter movement is being supported by an awful lot of young people who are brown and black and white. And they're saying this present is no longer acceptable. We need to build a different kind of future.
One of the things that you talk about in the book a lot is you say black lives matter, but so do blue lives.
Sure.
And you say you quote Plato in the Republic, talking about having to have guardians. And this is your vision for what police officers need to become, right?
Well, Plato talks about the critical role of the guardian. Really, it's the side of the police cars to serve and protect. And so the chapter is called From Warriors to Guardians. Our police should be guardians. And I've met police who really want to do that.
And what does it mean to be a guardian rather than a warrior?
Well, think about the difference in the job here. Warriors are highly militarized. They come in to deal with the enemy. And rather than saying, this is my community and I'm policing my community, and the trust that I have with people that I'm responsible for protecting, and their trust for me is critical here. That's a very different kind of role. I'm a little league baseball coach. I'd like to see cops as umpires and coaches and getting to know the community. So I'm talking to pastors who are taking the suggestions about reestablishing trust, building community. Community policing, taking that to their police departments and having these whole new conversations, almost serving as intermediaries between the police and the community. And so I think there's a real powerful possibility here and the guardian is what I think those who are drawn to be police for the right reasons, that's why they want to do it.
Yeah. I want to turn, if I can, to talk about evangelicals for a few minutes. Can we do that?
Sure.
Way back in 1974, You wrote this: the new evangelical consciousness is most characterized by a return to biblical Christianity and the desire to apply biblical insights to the need for new forms of socio-political engagement. Here's what I find fascinating about that long ago statement. You think of evangelicals entirely differently, and you think about biblical interpretation entirely differently than the way evangelicals have become portrayed and defined in today's political environment.
Well, as a political reporter, you'll understand when I say the term Iowa evangelicals has damaged the brand. What Iowa evangelicals seem to care about in this primary season. So I'll go back to the word evangelical. It comes from the word evangel, which was in Jesus' opening statement, his first gig, his mission statement, which he gave at Nazareth, what I call his Nazareth Manifesto. He quotes Isaiah. He says, "The Spirit of the Lord is upon me because he has anointed me to bring evangel, good news to the poor." Now, what that means, if the gospel helps cure your addictions, thanks be to God. If it turns your life around, saves your marriage, hallelujah. But if the gospel that you preach isn't good news to poor people, according to the text in Luke 4, it's not the gospel of Jesus Christ. So evangelicals meant to be good news to the poor, as Pope Francis has been articulating. I got kicked out of my church by bringing these issues up, so I joined the student movements of my time, and we could put 10,000 people in the street in about 2 hours in those days in Michigan. But I came back to my faith because of the text, which says, "I was hungry, I was thirsty, I was naked, I was a stranger, I was sick, I was in prison, and you didn't come to be with me." They all said, "Lord, when did we see you hungry and thirsty, naked, stranger, immigrant, sick and in prison?" And he says, "As you've done it to the least of these, you've done it to me," Matthew 25. And so really our politics should be tested, all the biblical prophets say, by how we treat the poorest and most vulnerable. That's not the first question that you hear in the debates. How are we treating the poorest and most vulnerable? That's, though, the biblical question of politics. So that's what we're trying to raise.
Randall Balmer, the Dartmouth right. professor, wrote a wonderful biography of Jimmy Carter a couple of years back called Redeemer. And one of the things that made it, I thought, exceptional was that he described how the evangelical movement made a 180-degree turn between when Jimmy Carter was running for president, where he had a lot of evangelical support because it was a progressive movement, to the end of his 4 years when Ronald Reagan, in fact, came along and brought those people over to him, and we saw in that 4 years almost a 180-degree flip.
And President Jimmy Carter also would talk about the history of this, where evangelical revivals were tied in with the abolition of slavery. And Charles Wesley would talk about altar calls where people come down the aisle to give their lives to Christ, mm-hmm. and they'd sign them up for the anti-slavery movement at the same time. So there's a whole history of this being a part of social movements, abolition of slavery, certainly civil rights. The black churches here in Atlanta were the core of the civil rights movement. So this whole idea of faith changing the world, pulpits are supposed to change history. And Ebenezer Baptist Church is a pulpit in this town where I've been blessed to preach, and that pulpit changed this nation. And so that whole notion of a faith that expresses itself in social justice is really, I think, the answer to that politicized white evangelical world.
Well, let me ask you about that. There's a college course you've taught, and it's described on the Sojourner website. How does faith inform public debates on social justice? Fine. How should religious leaders and politicians engage the political process while maintaining their moral witness? I guess the question that comes to me from that is, what is the role of faith in politics, especially this year in a presidential campaign?
Well, I believe in the separation of church and state. I do believe in that. But not the segregation of values
right.
from public life. And so, William Barber in North Carolina, the Moral Mondays movement. I talk about him in this book, and we talked just the other day, mounting a moral campaign, multiracial moral campaign that transcends politics. I say, don't go left, don't go right, go deeper. Go deeper to the moral issues at the heart of things. And how we're treating those who are most vulnerable is central here. So that should be our first political question. So we're really trying to build a movement all over the country where people put their faith into action, not for partisan politics, but to raise issues that aren't being raised in the political climate and need to be, and build real movements of ordinary people in the churches and outside of them around those questions. Your faith doesn't mean much if you're not doing what you say, if you're not taking it into public life, personal. God is personal, but never private. So how do you take your faith into public life? That's what I'm saying in this book in relationship to the deep issues of race.
In your last book, On God's Side, which talks about religion and politics, you quote Abraham Lincoln, who said, "My concern is not whether God is on our side. My greatest concern is to be on God's side." And essentially, that's what you're saying about religion or the moral values that religion teaches, and that's how that should interact with politics.
Which brings us to some humility about, asking, where is God in this? I talk in the book about the parables of Baltimore and Ferguson and now Chicago and Twin Cities. And parables are stories Jesus told so that we might learn the right lessons from. So what are the parables we learn from these places? Flint, the parable now going on, which teaches us that racism is in the air we breathe and the water that we drink. It's a very painful parable. And so the book talks about how repentance means more than saying you're sorry. It means moving from a segregated church to the beloved community that Dr. King and John Lewis talks about all the time. It means welcoming the stranger. It means, how do you move from punitive to restorative justice? Practically, how do we move toward different ways of thinking and acting and structuring our social life? What does it mean to build that bridge?
You sent out a tweet this morning, I think, or last night. To use anger politically, especially by turning people against each other, is one of the worst sins in politics.
Well, Donald Trump is fueling racial fear and racial hatred into our political atmosphere, which is poisoning and polluting the air we breathe. And blaming the other, always attacking the other, whether it be a black president who he says is not really one of us, he doesn't have a birth certificate, or black and Hispanic people in the urban areas who he blames for all the crime against white people, which is crazy and not true, immigrants, Mexicans, Muslims, banned Muslims all over the world from coming here. This is blaming the other for our problems.
But he's tapped into a deep vein that clearly many Americans agree with.
Well, what he's tapped into is how there are a lot of working-class whites who feel marginalized. Their wages are stagnant. Their kids are being sent off to wars that aren't working and killing and maiming their children. And they feel like they're being pushed aside. And Donald Trump wants them to blame immigrants for that, people of color for that, Muslims for that, black people, a black president for that. And what he doesn't want them to look at is how the economy is structured in a way that is marginalizing not just people of color, but a lot of now white working class people who are struggling to survive. And so that's, I think, the very ugly populism that Donald Trump is calling for. And what we really need is something that brings us together in new ways.
As we close, you've been a man of faith virtually your entire life. And you've also witnessed and written about some of the worst things that have happened in America during your lifetime. Does it ever occur to you that God might give up on us? Or, as you've witnessed these things, have you ever thought you ought to give up on God?
You know, sometimes I think we make God into our own image instead of trying to understand what it means to be made in the image of God. It grieves God when it must break God's heart when young black men are shot and killed, when there's no reason that they should have been, could have been, we could have done something different in that situation. I started to write this book when Trayvon Martin was shot and killed, and I looked at my son Luke, and 6 foot tall, playing college baseball next year, and the whole country knows that if Luke had been in Sanford, Florida, at the same time, the same place as Trayvon was, doing the same things, the whole country knows he'd have come back to me in joy. Trayvon didn't come back to his parents and isn't going to college next year. So, you know, that just violates what God intended when God created us in the image of God. It's as fundamental as that. And so for me, God grieves over this. Jesus has a broken heart when our racial divides are so deep. But I think we can change that. The Pope says we can change things. This whole idea of in Christ there is no Jew or Gentile, bond or free, male or female, that was a baptismal text that they used when they welcomed new converts to be publicly saying they're joining this. They're saying this community is overcoming those barriers, the divisive factors, race, class, gender. And if you don't want to be part of that, don't come here, because that's what we do. And around the world, the body of Christ, as they say, is the most multiracial community in the world. And so we can change this. And so I'm actually hopeful. I was in South Africa during the apartheid days, but I was at the inauguration of Nelson Mandela. And I saw a country just being transformed. And for me, I go back to my faith here in the biblical text. Hebrews says, faith is the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen. And my paraphrase of that is hope means believing in spite of the evidence and then watching the evidence change. This book talks about the evidence of continuing racism in this country, but also the evidence of people who think that has to change, and the possibilities that together we can build a bridge to a new America.
We've been talking with Christian writer and pastor Jim Wallace. He's the founder of Sojourner magazine and the author of 12 books, including his latest, America's Original Sin, Racism, White Privilege, and The Bridge to a New America. I do want to say that I think there are examples of conservative evangelicals acting out of Christian love and charity, a point Wallace neglected to make in our conversation. Atlanta's Johnson Ferry Baptist Church, for example, is a white conservative congregation. But when Georgia Governor Nathan Deal declared that Syrian refugees would not be welcomed in the state, the church members, led by Pastor Bryant Wright, announced that they would take in a Syrian refugee family. At the time, Wright said that Jesus, Mary, and Joseph themselves were refugees, and that taking in the family was the Christian thing to do. We're going to take a short break now. When we come back, I'll talk with Laura Turner Seidel. She'll share stories about growing up with her famous father, Ted Turner, and we'll explore her passionate dedication to the environment. Welcome back to Two Way Street. I'm Bill Nigut. Ted Turner is one of the world's great business visionaries, and through his enterprises, he helped put Atlanta on the world map. He's also a major philanthropist and a passionate advocate of protecting the environment and preserving the world's natural resources. He passed that passion on to his daughter, Laura Turner Seidel, who joined me in the Two Way Street studio to talk about life with her world-famous dad and about the causes that matter most to her. Laura, welcome to Two Way Street.
Well, thank you, Bill. It's wonderful to be here.
So let's talk a little bit, if we can, about your dad.
Sure.
And about his upbringing and how that may have had an impact on how he raised you, okay? There's a letter that played a large role in your father's life when he was in college. He decided he wanted to be a classics major at Brown, right?
That is right.
And his father, when he heard this, wrote him a letter. Can I read the very beginning of it?
Oh, go right ahead.
My dear son, I am appalled, even horrified, that you have adopted classics as a major. I almost puked on the way home today. I suppose I'm old-fashioned enough to believe that the purpose of an education is to enable one to develop a community of interest with his fellow men. And he goes on saying he's a practical man and classics isn't the route to practical business. That must have had a tremendous impact on your father when he was a college student.
You know, he had a lot of tough love growing up. And if you've read his book or heard him speak about it, you would know. And it's not easy to grow up in that environment. He was 4 years old and went off to boarding school. And that is a military school. And he spent more years in a military school at Macaulay. You've heard about that. And, you know, he lost his sister. His sister became very ill. And, of course, his father committed suicide later in life. But Dad was always pushed. He had his dad told him to set the goals so high that he could never achieve them. So he would always have something to work for. And, you know, I think my dad has achieved excellence, strived for and achieved excellence. But he also has emotional scars. But he's managed to deal with that and raise a family and change the world for the better. And as he's always says that he's very proud of the way his children have grown up. So me and my three brothers and my sister. So I think he's been a great father.
Did his father's tough love translate to the way he raised you and your siblings?
I think not as extreme. I would say he let us really go down the path that we wanted to choose for each of our lives. He instilled a strong work ethic. He really wanted us not to sit around and twiddle our thumbs. We all worked, and I think he really wanted us to contribute to society. But when he said, jump, you would say, how high? And children should be seen but not heard. And it was a little military. You know, he was in the Coast Guard, and so was his father. But it was always yes, sir, and no, sir. And if you forgot to say, and you said yeah, or just plain yes, you would get a big thump on the head that came out of nowhere. And it didn't take long before it was drilled into your head. So I do think that he was a bit of a dictator, but he always let us decide what we wanted to do with our lives. He didn't push us like his father pushed him.
Did you understand when you were younger that he was Ted Turner?
When we were growing up, he was always very tight with money. He didn't have a lot of it, and he always says he didn't get rich by spending money. He got rich by investing it well and saving it. It was a frugal raising up. And I don't think that we were raised with a silver spoon in our mouth by any means.
I know you've said that one of the things that influenced your father was that he really came along in the latter days of the Depression. He grew up, he was young, but his family was facing the end of the Depression when he was little.
Right. And I actually lived with my grandmother and great-grandmother for a couple of years in Cincinnati. And they really did live, you know, like it was a Great Depression. You didn't waste anything. You didn't waste food. If you got cold, you put on a sweater. My dad was like that too. If you left the room, you would turn the lights off. If you left the TV on, you would hear about it. You just didn't waste.
So in the mid-70s, your dad bought a little UHF station, Channel 17, and turned it into WTBS, one of the country's first superstations. Do you remember what was going on in your life at that point?
Well, that when you asked me what was, you know, my upbringing, I was remembering, you know, that little station,
yeah.
And it wasn't glamorous. We would head down to the station after church on Sundays and watch the wrestling matches from Dad's office. He had a big picture window.
Your dad really got that wrestling was a way to attract an audience, didn't he?
Truly, truly. But in the early days, he had bullfighting, too, which I was, do you remember that?
I suddenly do.
Yeah, and he had a little bit of news. You know, he had a German Shepherd sometimes fill in as an anchor, which is so funny. And then they had one of the anchors would wear a paper bag over his head. Remember Bill Tush? He would do the news. And it was so funny how he went to from the minimum amount of news to 24-hour news.
Yeah, and when he did launch CNN, in the very beginning, he was mocked by many people who said, who is going to watch news, especially coming out of Atlanta, this small-time operation? It was one of the first times that I was aware mm-hmm. of Ted Turner's willingness to say, I know what I'm doing. I don't care what the world says.
He was very confident, and he would become an expert in the field that he was interested in, and he would just hyper-focus, and he was confident enough to know that that's what the world needed and that it would do well.
Which is not to say that he did not struggle, has not struggled through his life with some personal demons.
I think we all struggle with personal demons
do,
at some point,
we?
But he did have, you know, from the obvious reasons. Being in military school when you are 4 years old, I mean, that is extreme. And then obviously, you know, his relationship with his father, and then losing his sister, and losing Jane and losing the company. I mean, there's been some, you know, upheavals in his life that would affect.
What was it like to be a kid and have a father who owned a Major League Baseball team?
my stepmother, the first Jane, she said her worst nightmare was overtime and rain delays, you know, because she would go to all the Hawks games and all the baseball games. And I like baseball, but I really don't follow it like I used to when he owned the team.
Your father's marriage to Jane Fonda was one of the biggest news stories in the social world for a very, very long time. What do you recall about first being introduced to her, how you felt about this movie star coming into your life? Was that an easy transition for you? Because I know you remain close to her, right?
Right. When Jane came into our life, you know, she was very good to him, sincerely loved him, was great to us, great to our children as a grandmother. I knew her for the good person that she was, and not all the hype. And obviously she had given up her career to be with Dad during that time. And so it wasn't like top of mind, oh, you know, who is this enormously famous person that is in our midst? She was a great listener. She gave great advice. She was a fabulous stepmother. And we all loved her dearly, and Dad still loves her dearly. They still have a close relationship.
Their relationship to an outsider seemed incredibly romantic.
It was. They were very much in love, and they weren't afraid one little bit to show the world that they were.
Clearly, your father had made enough money by the time you were an adult that if you'd wanted to spend your life just enjoying life, you really could have done that. You didn't go that direction. Why not?
I really think it came from the fact that our dad really taught us to be mindful and responsible. When Dad launched CNN, you could see around the world where a lot of conflict was happening and violence. It was due to the fact that the environment was degraded. You know, people were fighting over land. They were fighting over resources. There wasn't enough food to go around. Too many people vying for too few resources. And I think a lot of that has to do with the way we've treated the natural world.
I want to talk about your global reach.
Right.
But can we start it right at home?
Sure.
What is EcoManor?
Eco Manor was the first LEED certified house.
It's your home.
It's our home in the Southeast. We were striving to be, and just in case you didn't know, LEED stands for Leadership in Energy and Environmental Design. It's a very stringent certification that shows that that you've really, you know, are using the best technologies and best products in your house to reduce your energy and water use.
What are some examples of how you are friendly, more environmentally friendly, and more concerned about conservation?
Okay, so we have solar panels, about 9.9 kilowatts of solar on our rooftop. And we kind of did a faux roof, so we covered the panels because our neighbors, we live in a historic neighborhood. And although we think they're beautiful, our neighbors don't think that so much. We have tankless water heaters, which instead of keeping, you know, mega number of gallons boiling hot 24/7, you just heat the water that you're using at that moment in time. And then also we have geothermal, which is a very efficient way to heat and cool your house. We used all recycled materials, things that were sourced within a 500-mile radius of our home to cut down on transportation costs and emissions. Energy Star lighting and
what
appliances.
Does that mean?
Well, Energy Star relates to energy efficiency.
Okay.
So they're the most efficient light bulbs, lighting. So back when we did our house 10 years ago, it was compact fluorescent bulbs. And now the bulb technology has progressed so much, and they've removed the mercury out of the bulbs, and the quality of light is much better. And I don't know if you've heard of LED lights, so
yeah.
Light-emitting diodes, and they're like 90% more efficient than incandescent bulbs, and about 25% more efficient than fluorescent bulbs.
Do you have to be rich to do what you did at Eco Manor?
Well, we also started out at the front of the market when things are more expensive, and the prices, like on solar, have come down like 60% since we installed our array on our rooftop. A lot of those technologies have come down in price, and the appliances, and the cost of the bulbs.
I watched your TED Talk about world population, and you began it really by saying something fascinating. It took us from the beginning of civilization, you said, to 1864 to reach 1 billion people.
That's right.
On the planet. And then what?
And then 1920, they hit 2 billion, and we are over 7 billion now. And we, you know, are coming up against a brick wall. You know, the resources on this planet are not infinite. And we see that especially as it relates to water. In the groundwater, in aquifers. A lot of the ancient aquifers have been completely dewatered.
In that talk, you quoted another figure that was startling to me, that only 1% of the water...
Half of 1% is drinkable.
Is potable,
right.
Or can
accessible.
Be used for plants, for growth of food, for...
Right. And so there's a very small amount that is available. And we have been dewatering those aquifers, even the surface aquifers, faster than nature can replenish it.
So there's really kind of two prongs to this. One is the dwindling resources and your work to try to assure that we recoup them somehow.
Right.
But the other side of it that's a little harder to talk about is population control.
Oh, well, you don't call it... I don't think it's about controlling population. I think it's giving women the access to take control of their own lives and, you know, figure out how they want to time and space their families and space their children. And there are about 210 million women in developing countries that would like access to reproductive health care and voluntary contraception, and they can't get it.
You say almost half the women in Nigeria, for instance, you've done some surveys,
say they
would like access to information
36,000 women in Nigeria would like access, and they don't have it. I know birth control is played a very important role in my life, and I would really like...
What does that mean?
You know, I could have had 12 children. I wanted to have, you know, two or three children. My dad has a voluntary voluntary initiatives. And he said, you know, don't have more than one child. But, you know, we're kind of past that point. And he was, too, because he had five. But anyway, I just think that we have to empower women to be able to control their lives. And when they have fewer children, those children's lives are healthier and much better. Good news is Melinda Gates and the Gates Foundation thinks that this issue is very important as well. And in 2012, they hosted an international family planning conference and made a commitment of $1 billion and was able to leverage several other billions of dollars to provide voluntary contraception and family planning to the women of the world who want it.
Yeah. For me, the launch of what I want to play for you taught me a lot about my understanding of your family's concern about the environment. Let's listen.
Wind, water, hot, go planet!
By your powers combined, I am Captain Planet.
Captain Planet, he's a hero.
What is that?
That's Captain Planet.
Tell me about Captain Planet, Laura.
Well, it is the vision of my dad that he thought it was just super important to educate youth about issues of global significance. Captain Planet was the first and only eco superhero, and he had a band of youth that he worked with from different continents of the world. And what was great about it is it was seen in over 100 countries in 23 different languages. And it was the first time that children anywhere could see somebody that looked like them doing great things and working. It was kind of like a mini UN. And Captain Planet was like divine intervention. and so, you know, there are millions and millions of these planeteers all over the earth, young career professionals now that are moving up in every sector. And it's just wherever I travel, wherever Dad travels, you know, we run into these millennials that are doing great things. Then Dad decided that 25, and Captain Planet's 25 years old this year. And the
happy birthday.
I know. happy birthday. And over the course of 25 years, we've directly funded over 1 million youth and impacted over 10 million youth.
In this TED Talk that I watched, you said it is our moral obligation, no matter what religion you are, to deal with population growth. And I wondered when I heard you say that, when it comes to things like protecting the environment, protecting families, how big a role does religion play in your personal philosophy?
Well, you know, that's good. Good question to ask. I believe that we have to be compassionate and help others, help them achieve what they want to achieve in their own lives, and then also watch out for the children that are here now and future generations.
It strikes me that Captain Planet is an example of the fact that your dad always saw a bigger dimension to everything he did. It wasn't just about having a TV station that ran cartoons. It was, how can I take cartoons and teach valuable lessons? It wasn't just about making a fortune, having a cable news network. It was giving $1 billion to the UN to try to work toward global peace. That really is a remarkable thing about him, and you've continued that tradition.
But he also set a very high bar for other millionaires and billionaires who were committed to being number one on the on the Fortune 500 list. And Dad went to Warren Buffett and Bill Gates and just said, you know, let's think this thing through. Why don't you guys, you know, work to be on, you know, set a new standard, a new list, a list of philanthropy, a list of charity. And now the giving pledge exists. You've got two giving pledgers right here in Atlanta besides Ted, and that's Sarah Blakely and Arthur Blank, but they're, you know, they're now all over the world.
But the point is, his passions are deeply embedded in who you are as well. Thank you for being with us, Laura Turner-Seidel.
Well, thank you for having me, Bill.
Laura Turner Seidel is the daughter of business visionary and philanthropist Ted Turner. Like her father, she's devoted herself to protecting the environment and preserving the world's natural resources. If you'd like to learn more about her work and the work of the Turner Foundation, you'll find links on the Two Way Street Facebook page and on our website at gpbnews.org. Just point your cursor to the programs button and you'll find us there. Welcome back to Two Way Street. Two Way Street producer Jenny Amet loves discovering new places, meeting new people, and recording sound wherever she goes. So we thought, what the heck, let's let her do it on occasion for Two Way Street. Jenny, you have put together an audio montage of the Oyster Man. Who's the Oyster Man?
Well, his name is Brian Rackley. He's co-owner at the Kimball House, and oysters are his thing. When I went there the first time, I was thinking that I would get an oyster and a cracker and hot sauce, you know, like regular oysters. And I looked at the menu, and there's all these different kinds of oysters. And on top of that, they have these crazy descriptions.
So Kimball House is a restaurant in Decatur, and that's where you met with Brian one morning.
Right. So I went and visited Brian in the morning at Kimball House. And what he was doing was he had the menu out, and he was tasting all these oysters to reevaluate his tasting notes. And I sat down with him while he was doing that.
Sometimes I'll eat an oyster and I'm just like, man, that tasted a lot like an oyster. And then some days you taste one and you're like, all sorts of stuff happened, just nuance all over the place. Standing in the oyster bar with my eyes closed, taking deep breaths, breathing in the flavors of these oysters. It would look ridiculous to anybody who's watching me. This is an oyster blade. They don't necessarily all shuck the same.
Yeah.
This is the hinge. So you just take the tip of this knife and you kind of wiggle it in there, kind of like you're revving a motorcycle a little bit. And then you pop that hinge off, take the cap and pull it away. And then once the oyster's exposed, I just take that knife. And then you just kind of slide underneath and you separate that muscle. The first thing I kind of like to do is just sip a little bit of the liquor. Man, these are right on right now. They're just so bright and lemony and grassy. When I taste something and it just jumps out at you, it's super exciting from a standpoint of somebody who's trying to relay information, because it doesn't always come very easy. Cucumbery, sweet vegetal flavors up front, like a note of sorrel or even like the tendrils from cucumbers when they're a little bit more bitter and they haven't sweetened as much. Or even like a pea tendril, maybe a little bit. Literally just like tastes like biting down on a handful of sea beans, which I don't know if you have had those, but it's great. It's like eating sea popcorn. Royal Miyagi, those are from British Columbia. Those tend to have like a lot of like dairy qualities to me. And a little bit woody, lemony citrus in there. Just a touch of bitter sourness up front. The fruit makes way for more vegetation as you kind of let it develop in your mouth. All right, let's try something from anise and bitter greens. That one to me, yeah, it has a little bit of this weird licorice-y thing going on. Yeah, it tastes like cured meat with a little smear of butter on it. That's good. I'm going to rewrite that one for sure. I think it just leaves me with this like, this chilling, oh my God, what was that? To start off sweet and almost like haunting baking spice, and then to finish dry and acidic. It's just, it's strange, and just, you know, it makes me want to just go back. You know, I mean, we offer cocktail sauce, we offer lemons, we offer mignonette, we have accoutrements. It's been a long time since somebody came up to the oyster window and said, so-and-so is asking for crackers. What do you recommend? You know, it just doesn't happen as much as it used to. And I think it's because people are learning to appreciate oysters for what they provide naturally rather than masking them with crackers and stuff like that. They like what we're doing without hot sauce. We had one gentleman, I think he ate. He might have eaten like, hey, does anybody know what Ted's record was? 178. And that he did that here? Yeah. No one should eat that many oysters.
Have a banana, Hannah. Try the salami, Tommy. Give it to gravy, Davy. Everybody eats when they come to my house. Try a tomato plate too. Here's cacciatore, Dory. Taste of bologna, Tony.
That was Two Way Street's Jenny Ahmed's piece about Brian Rackley, who samples oysters and chooses the right ones to serve at Kimball House, a restaurant in Decatur. That's all the time we have for this week's Two-Way Street. Remember, if you can't be near a radio when we're on the air, you can always listen to us by downloading the Two-Way Street podcast on iTunes, or you can download the GPB Atlanta mobile app, where you'll find Two-Way Street, Political Rewind, On Second Thought with Celeste Headlee, and all your favorite NPR shows. Our producer is Jenny Ament. I'm Bill Nigut. Hope to see you again next week for another Two-Way Street.